thought it particularly appropriate for our observance of Founders Day this year to take note of the observance by Springfield Seminary of its 125th anniversary. It is, I think, significant to note that both of our institutions' founding antedate the formation of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. We somehow have something to say to Mother. And we felt that we could best observe our own Founders Day this year by inviting President Schultz to come and speak to us about the interesting history which Concordia Seminary in Springfield has had. And by that action to demonstrate the brotherhood which we share, we two seminaries, our faculties, and our students. And as a further demonstration of that brotherhood, I should like to introduce Mr. Kenneth Rupar, our student body president, who has a presentation to make. Mr. Rupar.
Dr. Schultz, on behalf of the students of Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, we'd like to present to you this processional banner to your students at Concordia Springfield. We know that the Lord has continued to use your seminary to bless people through service, and so we've asked Seminarian David Muhlenbrook to make this banner helping to symbolize for you and for us the fact that the Lord's service goes throughout many, many areas of our lives and takes many forms. I present to you this banner.
Thank you very much. We'll keep it in our chapel as a constant remembrance of our brotherhood.
This is yours, incidentally. We expect to have an opportunity a little bit later in the course of this year to make a presentation on behalf of the faculty and the staff of Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis to the faculty and staff of Concordia Seminary in Springfield on that occasion when our two faculties come together. But at this particular time, I should like to read this citation from us to you. Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, Missouri, extends praise to God and fraternal good wishes upon the observance of the 125th anniversary of Concordia Theological Seminary, Springfield, Illinois. Our faculty, board, and staff ask the Lord of the Church for his continued blessing on your faithful service in preparing men for ministry in the Church. Dated November 10, 1971, and signed by me. Dr. Schultz, we present this to you and welcome you to Concordia Seminary and look forward to hearing your words.
Thank you very much, John. I appreciate very much the opportunity of being here and having you celebrate our birthday. We're getting a little bit weary of some of the celebrations, but they seem to go on and on. But I think it's important to talk a little bit about the history of Springfield. I found out all kinds of interesting vignettes, primarily, and I'd like to preface my remarks with this, primarily from the very detailed work that our dear friend Eric Heinzen, who died in my arms about a month ago, had done in preparing this history of the Springfield Seminary. Sometime today yet, I hope to have a consultation at CPH. We would very much like to get this work published. It wasn't quite finished, but it's one of the most sprightly written histories I've ever seen. I dug out some interesting facts. John, for instance, that this seminary is older than the Springfield Seminary, but the Springfield Seminary is Synod's oldest institution. That seminary was at Fort Wayne, it was immediately deeded to the Synod in 1847. Eric says that the Altenburg College was not deeded until 1850, so that's how that comes about. All kinds of interesting things have happened up there. You know, when you become president of a place, you begin to notice how peculiar many people are, strange habits. And you begin to dig a little bit to find out how in the world we got that way. And in the case of this strange Springfield Seminary, I think that we can find some underlying concepts in theological education which are not yet settled, and I'd like to point that out somewhere near the end. Strange things. One day, a giant black man appeared at the door of the seminary with a gold-tipped cane and in the fanciest wagon he could rent in Springfield. Immediately moved into a solo room on the third floor of the sheep stable or castle gardens and completed the curriculum. The person who reported this, and I thought you'd like this, the person who reported this said he was sent on a vicarage to the south and I never heard from him again. Strange things. During the 1930s, there was a time when a big brouhaha developed over who was going to pay all the doctor bills for all the students who were suddenly getting themselves circumcised. Now, this was prior to the time when this was considered a hygienic movement. No one has ever figured out why that happened, but something happened along the line. Well, to put it in a little historical perspective for you, there are giants who walk the earth in the history of Springfield. I used to hold over the heads of my students in class the fact that if they didn't behave, I would recommend them for moose jaw when they got their calls. There was a young candidate in Germany, and his name was Leo, whom you know, of course, who, when the calls were being handed out or assignments were being made or something, hoped and prayed fervently that if there was one place in all of Germany he would not be sent to, it would be Neuendettelsau. And you know that he was sent exactly there, a hopeless town. I think that there's a lesson in this. The Lord does strange things, and he uses things which we would reject, as we know. It humbles you much when you read in the Old Testament that Nebuchadnezzar was a golden chalice in the hands of the Lord. And Neuendettelsau, I don't think it had any streets, and it was the last place this man wanted to go. But by the grace of God, and in God's mysterious ways of working, Neuendettelsau became a world center of evangelism and world missions. This man, with the hand of God upon him, was able to take about the worst call that any candidate could get and turn it into a shining golden chalice in the hands of the Lord. That's a good lesson. Well, anyway, Leah was deeply concerned about the Germans in America, and of course later on when Wieneken came over and wrote his famous tract, The Appeal to the Germans to Take Care of These Poor Scattered Immigrants, an interesting crossfire was set up. Leah had his concern, Wieneken was able to translate it into activity and appeal for funds and for men to come over, and it was out of this kind of context that the seminary in Fort Wayne actually met in the Wieneken home at first. Later on, Pastor Seeler, who had been the pastor who had led the people up into the Frankenmuth area, came down and took over the seminary. The basic idea of the founding of the Fort Wayne Seminary, which later became the St. Louis B, and I'll explain that, and then Springfield, and almost St. Louis B again. And, you know, there never has been a year when somebody hasn't argued the point of what you should do about Springfield. This is part of our psychology. You've got to understand this. Nobody, to my knowledge, has ever suggested closing St. Louis, except once. And that wasn't very recently. In 1935, I knew you'd get that. In 1935, at the Cleveland Convention of Synod, the seminary in Springfield was actually closed by one vote. The action was reconsidered. In those days, they thought, well, you really shouldn't do anything by one vote. And either the next day or a couple of days later, it was reconsidered and stayed open by about 30 votes, I guess. But it was interesting to see a board of control fight back with great vim and vigor. This was an overture which the Board of Control of Concordia Seminary in Springfield presented to that convention of synod. We had hoped that synod's action in 1932 would serve once and for all to lay this vexing question. It has not, and therefore we again ask synod to declare decisively, listen, that there is not only room... Well, I've got to find the other page. In Synod's educational program for the system represented by the Springfield College and Seminary, the bomb is coming yet, but that this system can best be served and its program best be carried out by restricting it to one institution, the Springfield Seminary. That's what you call throwing a curve in order to avoid some kind of action. Well, I think that... this is something that needs to be said. The history of the seminary is loaded with these great men, notably August Cramer, C-R-A-E-M-E-R, who for 41 years was president or director, and there were a couple of years he didn't know what he was, but he led the place. One of the most austere, hard-working men that this synod has ever turned out. When this man collapsed in chapel and was carried to what became his deathbed, what he was still muttering was that to be sure to tell them not to give me my paycheck, because now that I'm sick I can't work and I don't deserve it. And he meant it. In his last delirium, he was still loudly lecturing to students. They said this went on for a couple of days. At that point it was a delirium. But the man actually died in harness. There was no grass grown in those days because it cost money to cut the grass. He believed in absolute austerity and thought that the seminaries ought to be the most austere places in the world, because this was the only way to train men for the realities of ministry. Well, to get back on the historical track, the basic reason for founding the seminary in Fort Wayne was to produce emergency pastors. I get the idea that it's something like this licensed lay preacher business that's being talked about and that was voted at the Milwaukee Convention. These were note helper. That was the original intention. Leia saw that you had to get somebody out there with a Bible in his hand and preach to these people and get the babies baptized and bury the people and offer them the sacraments. And he said, you don't need much for that. You need a basic understanding of how to tell a Bible story, how to preach a fairly acceptable sermon. You can do it. Leia was doing it in 1 year in his own home. And then when he began to send men to be trained over here, the program was expanded to 2 years and then 3 years. But you must keep that in mind. Leia was under no misapprehensions, that this was theological education. He didn't intend it as such. He fully intended, before he finally had all of his problems and broke with the Columbus Seminary and finally with the Fort Wayne and with just about everybody, he fully intended to found a Latin school in Michigan. and that was to be a full-blown German theological seminary with the full panoply of everything else. So here was the situation. There wasn't time to wait around until you could get a theological seminary going. Therefore, you formed a lay training school and ordained a man, whatever you wanted. And it is true that until the 1870s, this practical seminary, as it came to be called, produced most of the pastors of the synod. And then by that time, the great system, the cranking up, cranking students through the gymnasia, the 6 years of the junior colleges and so on, began to pick up steam. And at that point, St. Louis then began to produce more pastors. But if you understand the sociological, religious situation of the time, you can see how this idea of a practical seminary versus a theological seminary came about. There are all kinds of interesting things. It's interesting to note that, in spite of that, this is Concordia Seminary, and our charter in Springfield reads Concordia Theological Seminary. I get amused by little things like that that happen in history. Well, in 1861, things were getting a little crowded at Fort Wayne. They didn't have too much. And the students at St. Louis out on Jefferson Street were rattling around, and therefore the seminary, the gymnasium of the St. Louis Seminary, was moved to Fort Wayne, and that's where we got the old bunk from. Now that's the school, for those of you who look younger with your hats off, which antedates the senior college, the old gymnasium six-year school that some of us here attended, was moved there, and the practical seminary moved into the same buildings with the other seminary, as it became lovingly called, and probably often still is. And that existed for quite some time. Seeler favored it and actually pushed it. He thought that this was the thing to do. Let's get these two seminaries together, and we can still run basically two curricula. We can run the regular curriculum, which is for a theological seminary based on German theology, and we can, along with it, and in the same campus, we can run men through who will also be pastors, but who, it will generally be known, will probably not aspire ever to teaching in a synodical school. They probably won't end up as a district president, but there are many, many places that don't need any more. As I say, it's interesting to see this idea coming back again. Now, we have five applications from men who have only a high school education and want to come to the seminary. We won't accept them on that basis. We still have room for a few who don't have a bachelor's degree, but not any with no college at all. And yet it's interesting to see how we are being besieged by pastors all over the place. These are good guys. Granted, they didn't go to school, but they've made a pretty good living, and there are congregations that could use them. And this is where this licensed lay preacher idea came from. This thing has recurred again and again throughout the history of synod. In 1873, and that was the time of a panic, when everybody was going broke, a depression we'd call it, the St. Louis Seminary began to get crowded now. Previously, they had lots of room to welcome the Fort Wayne brethren. Synod was asked for $80,000 to put up a new building out there, and, well, things were different in those days. They didn't have any money. So they said, well, you've got to do something else. We'll throw the practical seminary out. You couldn't move them back to Fort Wayne because there already was a school there. Just at that time, and this is an interesting history in itself, the Illinois State University, ISU, which has nothing to do with the present ISU up in Normal, some little old English academy that somebody had gotten started in Springfield went dead broke. The history of that academy, actually the campus that we're on, or a little corner of it, is closely connected with some of the Lincoln lore. Lincoln, actually, Abraham Lincoln's son attended, mainly because Lincoln got hoodwinked into buying a scholarship for $40, and he had to find somebody to use it. And because he paid the $40 and sent his son there, they elected him to the board of trustees of that little college. He never attended a meeting, because shortly thereafter he was elected president and left Springfield forever until they brought him back in a box. But that school went broke. Primarily it was connected with the old General Synod. It was sort of Lutheran. They were trying to run simultaneously a Lutheran religious college and a general educational institution, and the faculty kept fighting, and that's something that doesn't happen anymore either. And they finally went broke. There were some people at Trinity Lutheran Church in Springfield that sort of got a hold of it, put up the money, and said, well, we think this is the answer to all of Synod's problems. I want you to keep that in mind. When that property was bought, it was presented as the answer to all of Synod's problems. That's how they got to Springfield. The history of the seminary in Springfield is dotted with all kinds of interesting events, some of them very, very tragic. In 1888, for instance, the great typhus outbreak, in which I think it was 9 students that year died, and the following year 2, the entire school was under rather vicious attack. The typhus was blamed on a number of things, primarily on the poor plumbing. And there's probably some truth in it. One of these days we're going to get that fixed. The story that finally gained greatest credence was that one student walking in the town found a little black child who was cold and hungry and evidently ill, and brought him to his dormitory room and washed him and clothed him and fed him, and that this child had typhus, and that this is where it spread, and the center of it was on the grounds at the seminary. In 1897, again, a synod attempted to close Springfield. This thing kept popping up. The basic question, do you need 2 seminaries? Wouldn't it be cheaper? All kinds of basic concepts here. Those who looked at it economically said, let's just have 1 seminary. Some looked at it way back in those days, in 1897. The idea was already extant, possibly before that you need 2 faculties. And why do you need 2 faculties? So they can watch each other. And this idea of having 2 faculties was very definitely encouraged. I don't think ever officially by any synodical resolution, but it was definitely encouraged. You would hear it on the floor of Synod. You must maintain 2 faculties, and their basic function is to keep each other on the straight and narrow. Now, maybe understanding that that is not a recent thought, that this thing goes far back into the history of Synod, may explain some of the situations, some of the problems with which we struggle today. But that needs to be kept in mind. Synod was forever doing temporary things at Springfield. In 1880, for instance, there was an attempt to move it back to St. Louis, and that failed, and Synod got very magnanimous and said, we'll build you a new building. And that was the advent of the old sheep stable. The sheep stable was a building with vertical boards, and the inside had black tar paper. This was a dormitory, classroom, and a couple of other things. It eventually blew down in a storm. But now it was continually the idea, and I'm stressing this because I think part of the Dr. Heinzen called the survival psychology of Springfield, which I find still existing in rather sensitive forms, is part of the institution, that you are constantly living on the verge of closing and somebody saying, well, for heaven's sake, don't spend any money because one of these days we're going to close you up anyhow. And this is why a rather highly placed official of the Missouri Synod endeared himself to our faculty not too many years ago by proudly stating in the midst of a convocation address that Springfield was the cesspool of the Missouri Synod. He has never been invited back since. But you could understand what he meant, and it might have been a little indelicate, but the idea was still there that this constant hesitation, do you want two kinds of seminaries and so on. Since the 1940s, I believe, most of this has changed, I think largely the result of the tremendous need for both St. Louis and Springfield as the result of World War II, I think, put a quietus on much of this, let's close the place. I think there were a lot of sins. I stand here as an alumnus of this great institution and confess that all I ever knew about Springfield, and I should have kept my big mouth shut, all I ever knew about it was that I rode through it on the Ann Rutledge or the Abe Lincoln on the way from St. Louis to Chicago on the old Alton line. And that when it stopped in Springfield, somebody invariably would say, hey guys, we're in Springfield, ha ha ha. Not one of us had ever taken the trouble to read a stitch of history, to understand why we had it, to understand what was going on, and to be sympathetic. And this is why we're very grateful for the moves between our student bodies today. Granted, the gap between the educational accomplishments of the two student bodies has closed considerably, but nevertheless, we did a lot of dirty things in those days. We did it to the pastors in the field who, if they were Springfield graduates, and many of them very fine, outstanding pastors, some of them didn't get all that much education at the seminary, but they learned how to study. And so often we hung this label on them, you know, oh, a Springfielder, ha ha. And I think we have to understand that this church body again and again every year has to confess that on all sides we tend to do this because of our own insecurities, perhaps, our own sense of superiority at times. Every one of us in one way or another does it. The label nailing, you know, without thinking, without examining, without saying, brother, I'll take the time to understand you. So we are proud. I could tell you many more things about the history of Springfield. We're proud of the accomplishments, feeling that the Lord has vastly used the institution, that he will. It's in his hands anyhow. I can live with survival psychology because I live with that every day. I could fall out of this pulpit. I think it's Christian to live with survival psychology, and I can live with it as long as I know that we are doing the work of the Lord in preparing men to be preachers of that great and wondrous good news, and to go out and tell this crazy mixed-up world what God's up to and what God has done and continues to do for them. We're happy about our accreditation, and we intend to maintain the standards of the clergy. We fully subscribe to Walther's real concern, you know, for an educated clergy. And I won't back down on this at all. I think that we need more education today if we're to serve adequately. All right, so we can develop the paraprofessionals. I'm sure we could use more of them, but not at the expense of tearing down the educational qualifications as well as the personal qualifications of the clergy of tomorrow. The church of the past, and as I look at our synod, I think we need to underscore this. The church has been blessed largely by the fact that it has taken the time and spent the money to educate its clergy. Well, nevertheless, the issue remains, and one that we need to be working on together, and it's constantly raised, as you discuss this practical versus the theoretical seminary. What kind of education do we need in the theological schools of today? And I think the worst thing we can do is to be able to give a complete answer to that question. Some do. They know exactly. I've been doing considerable work. It's interesting to see the development of concepts in theological education since Niebuhr wrote his book, which was sort of the watermark, the benchmark of what theological education should be. What was the date? 54, I believe, or 57. To see the progression in it, we need to grow together in our understanding that we must educate our clergy to meet the world as it faces them out there. This means increasing needs for growth in the ability to communicate in the idiom and with the equipment and the machinery of our day. It means increasing ability to understand the social scene. To be able even to read a newspaper and know what's going on requires a man of great acumen and one who has been immersed in some of the social and behavioral sciences of our day. These are the directions that we need to go. Springfield, I think, has limped at times. Sometimes it has been much more pious than prudent, and perhaps we'll continue to do some of those things, but at least we have, I think, the vision of serving our church body effectively to produce pastors who can work side by side with their brothers from this seminary, and they are. One of the happiest things I find as I get out into the church is finding some of our recent graduates who can't wait to introduce me to their neighbors again, some recent graduates of St. Louis. And these guys are pastoring graduates of both of our seminaries. And that's the thing that makes your heart sing. We are 125 years old. We appreciate your congratulations, and we would like to pledge to you, and I speak for our faculty and student body, in the coming years, an increasing use of the love, the concern, and the common task which the Lord has handed to us. The Synod has given it to us also, of course, but the important thing is that we serve Jesus Christ shoulder to shoulder and heart to heart. And that would be my wish. If I had to cut a birthday cake and say, make a wish, that would be it. Thank you very much.
Dr. Schultz, that applause is an expression of our love and affection for you and for all of our colleagues and fellow students at Springfield. We pledge to you our own commitment to that task which you laid out for us. We see ourselves as serving together with you as partners in the task of preparing men for ministry and assisting our church body in being a more effective vehicle of God's mission in our world. We ask that you bring to our colleagues and fellow students at Springfield our greetings and our love and affection.